My guest is Robert Bly. He's considered one of the leading voices in American poetry. His early poems in the 1950s were reflective about nature and solitude. In the mid-60s, Bly wrote that America needed political poetry, and he became an anti-war activist. In the mid-70s, Bly's inspiration turned from political issues to mythology and fairy tales. More recently, he's devoted himself to writing about men, about the bonds between male friends and between father and son. I asked Robert Bly to begin by reading one of his early poems.
All right, I'll read one that I wrote in the 20s. I think that every man and woman in the 20s has a fear that somehow, by entering into life, they will lose their soul. So I wrote something like that. It's called The Danger of Loss. On a clear day, the jealous are jealous of ash leaves, flies, all jewelry of air. They sit gloating and grumpy with rage in their blowing hair. But the kind pine, though heavenless, does not drop green tears on earth, and partnerships of sheep walk half asleep on the mountains of death. But a man may lose the jewel on earth because of wife or job. For what he saves, he cares nothing and goes sullenly to a deep grave. I must say that if I were writing it now, I wouldn't put the word wife in there. Men don't lose the jewel because of wife. I would put, but a man may lose the jewel on earth because of job or job. For what he saves, he cares nothing and goes sullenly to a deep grave.
If you had read this when you wrote it back when you were in your 20s, would you have read it the same way you did now?
I doubt it, because a great thing is involved in poetry readings, when people speak the poems aloud, is that over the course of years as you read, you become used to your own voice and the way it rises and falls on its own, which one doesn't hear when one writes. So these readings have been a great gift to me in that way.
You grew up in rural Minnesota and went to school in a one-room schoolhouse. And you lived in New York for a while, went to Harvard. But you returned to Minnesota and live again in rural Minnesota. And I wonder if that part of America has a grip on you, or if you feel like you need to live there to write your poems.
I must say that when you're going to write poetry in your life, what you need primarily is a way to live without earning much money. And my father had saved a farm for me. I didn't get any income out of it, but I could live there. So I went there out of desperation, not out of choice. And living in the country is very boring. But after all, who says that poets should live in exciting places? And then, to my surprise, once I went there, it tied back somehow to my childhood. And I was able to use words like snow and dust and cottonwood tree that had meant a lot to me in my childhood. And strangely enough, it wasn't until I did that, I was about 28, 29 then, that my first poems actually sort of coalesced, came together. So I've become very enamored of the idea of spending a lot of time where you were born.
But you're known in your community as a poet.
Yeah.
Are you known as an eccentric, too?
Yeah, I suppose. Of course. Because I am.
How so?
I don't know. It's just that when you wander around and sit under trees for a while and try to write poems, people feel you're eccentric. I don't feel so. I feel myself perfectly normal.
I'm always surprised, in a way, when a poet comes from a family or from a community where there isn't a lot of poetry or writing around. Now, I think it's fair to say that in your family there wasn't a big emphasis on literature. You probably weren't brought up reading great literary magazines.
No, that's right.
How were you exposed to literature and to poetry?
I enlisted in the Navy when I was 17, in the middle of the Second World War. There I met a man from Portland, Connecticut, and he wrote a poem in front of me. I was astounded. It's the first person I'd ever seen write a poem. And it taught me something that I had never understood. I thought poems were written by books or something, and by Englishmen. And then I realized I could write a poem. Then I went to St. Olaf College for a year, and I fell in love with a girl who wrote poetry, and I tried to write some to impress her. it didn't do any good, and the poetry was no good. But nevertheless, I felt something on the page that I hadn't intended to put there. And then I transferred to Harvard, and that gave me a sense of the possibility, which I didn't have in the Middle West at that time, of undertaking writing poetry as an actual kind of profession.
What was the reaction of your parents to your desire to become a poet, not the most lucrative profession?
My father has his faults, but in that he was wonderful, and he never bothered me at all. I lived in New York working one day a week in my middle 20s and would come home very poor and wiped out and sick. And the only thing he'd ever said, he said, you know, if you got a job, you might be able to write more, which was very gentle, wasn't it? Very gentle.
Your early poems were very reflective, even pastoral, mm-hmm. many of them about nature.
They weren't pastoral. They were about where I was living. Happened to be in the country. I believe, you know, Machado and the Spanish say, write about where you are. If I'd been living in a city, they would have been urban.
Did you go through a period of solitude when you were starting off writing?
Well, as a matter of fact, when I got out of college, the best decision I made was not to go to graduate school. And I moved to New York, and I lived alone there for 2 years. And even though it was in the city, it was a very deep solitude because I was broke and also neurotic. And so I sometimes didn't talk to anyone for a month at a time. And that was wonderful.
Did it help you hear your inner voice
to not
be surrounded by other people?
Yes, a great blessing, great blessing, great blessing. I think the ego is very wounded when we get out of college, and mine was. And so my self-esteem was very wounded. I lived, as in my 20s, a classic life, as it turns out, of the young writer, say, in France. You go into a garret, you live there for 2 years, and you're a complete failure and complete nothing.
Did you, in your early years, feel connected to any larger tradition within poetry of Midwestern poets or of any Norwegian tradition? You come from a Norwegian family.
In the 50s, you know, there was no there wasn't any community of poets as there was in the 60s. I lived in New York for 2 years and never met a single writer, except for a European exile who stopped me on the street one day and said, are you a poet? And I said, wow, this is unbelievable. Yes. And he asked me to translate his work and so on. It was wonderful. There wasn't a tradition in Midwestern poetry. And the tradition that I had was through Yeats, and still is. I read him every day. He's my view of what a great poet is. And Frost every day.
You went from this period of solitude and of living in New York, feeling very disconnected. Then you moved back to Minnesota because you got a farm for...
Yes, because I realized that I needed time if I was going to write anything. Some people begin early. I didn't. And for various reasons, which I know now is connected somewhat to the alcoholic parent, namely the denial of feelings that are involved in that. Well, if you're involved in heavy denials of feeling, how can you become a poet, which is a thing in which the emotions and the body and the brain all have to speak together? I needed time to sort that out. And so I could live on a farm for very little.
One of your early poems is about ambition. Would you read it for us?
Yeah, that's a nice thing to ask for at this moment, because in Harvard, really, we were all taught to be ambitious. I don't know what that means. It means to send your poems to the New Yorker all the time, whatever that is. Then I started to read the Buddhist, and the Buddhist said, no, that's completely off. That's completely wrong. To be a poet means to drop out of the world of ambition and allow things to speak from below. So I wrote this. We had a farm. There wasn't any water on it, so I had to pump water for the horse. And I had a single horse, and I wrote this poem. It's a four-line poem called Watering the Horse. How strange to think of giving up all ambition. Suddenly, I see with such clear eyes the white flake of snow that has just fallen in the horse's mane. And, of course, that belongs in the Chinese way. You just put the two things together and leave it to the reader to figure it out.
Do you feel that you resolved that question of ambition for yourself?
No, I don't think so at all. I'm not a Buddhist. I'm a Norwegian Lutheran, so I go back to being ambitious every once in a while.
Ambitious
it's
and guilty.
It's the playing with it that's so fun. It's the playing with having no ambition. Or is it the playing with having ambition? I don't know.
My guest is poet Robert Bly. In the 60s, your poetry became very political, and you co-founded American Writers Against the War in Vietnam. What What happened to you that made your poetry change so much? Your poetry, which had been reflective about nature, it was now very political, and some of it was really pretty angry.
I think the poems come from the same place any poems come from, somewhere in the stomach. And at that time, it was anger and rage, partly at the betrayal of American ideals, which I had taken in. I felt the Second World War was a just war, whether it was or not. We felt it was so. But I didn't feel that way about the Vietnam War. So it was, and people were very upset at the time, you know. They said, listen, you do very well with trees, you know, why don't you stick with trees? Stop writing this stuff. But I'll read you. Would you like to hear one?
Yeah, why don't you read a couple?
This one is called As the Asian War Begins. There are longings to kill that cannot be seen, or are seen only by a minister who no longer believes in God, living in his parish like a crow in its nest. And there are flowers with murky centers, impenetrable, ebony, basalt. Conestogas go past, over the Platte, murderers from the Carolinas riding under the canvas. Who are our enemies? Perhaps the soldiers and the poor, those unable to rejoice. The last phrase is from a wonderful poem by Edward Thomas, the friend of Robert Frost. The soldiers and the poor, those unable to rejoice. So it's very sad to think that in a way it's the poverty of the people in Nicaragua that really infuriates us and makes us want to kill them. And I think another thing is that we, you know, in the Second World War, I noticed that we respected the Germans because they're big, but the Vietnamese were small. We like Buicks and Germans. And I noticed that we counted up the bodies in the Vietnam War. We never did that in the Second World War. It was heavy casualties on the German front. So I wrote this little poem. Counting small bone bodies. Let's count the bodies over again. If we could only make the bodies smaller, the size of skulls, we could make a whole plain white with skulls in the moonlight. If we could only make the bodies smaller, maybe we could fit a whole year's kill in front of us on a desk. If we could only make the bodies smaller, we could fit a body into a finger ring for a keepsake. Forever. For those of you who were too young for the war, that's what it felt like.
What reaction did you get from other poets? You were really one of the first poets to write about the war in Vietnam. You read at demonstrations. Was it accepted in the poetry establishment, accepted by your peers also to do such political work in the mid-60s?
I don't think so. In the academic community, I suppose it wasn't very established. But we were too busy to bother about that. Only Berryman, I think, called me many names and said I was ruining poetry, John Berryman.
Some political poets and playwrights can really get away with murder in a way, because if you're perceived as being politically correct and politically righteous, then it's easier sometimes to get by with form that's not as good. Do you know what I mean? I wonder if you ever felt like people wouldn't notice that much if a poem wasn't as well crafted as you'd like, because the political sentiments would catch on.
Oh, certainly. And people said at the time, you know, aren't you afraid that this political poem will be bad? And I said, well, how strange it is that when I write love poems, you don't say, aren't you afraid that this love poem will be bad? After all, a poem is made out of words, that's all. It's easy to throw them away when they're no good. You just tear up the page and throw it out. Why do we worry that political poems would be bad but not love poems? So there's some fear there. And I'm not saying that the fear isn't justified. Sometimes political poetry can wipe out some sort of subtlety and energy in the language. But I don't think it happened in this particular case.
You had gone from being someone who was isolated to someone who was really at the center of things. You were organizing writers against the war. You were a focal point in the anti-war movement yourself. How did it change your life? I know this is a kind of very, it's a personal, not political question I'm asking, I guess.
Well, I'll say two things. First of all, it pulled me away from my desk a lot. And I had read poems, but always with my hands down. I mean, I'd spoken poems before that, but always with my hands down at my side or holding a book. And it turns out that if you memorize a poem and you speak it with as great clarity as you can, with as strong emotions that are yours as you can, a brief community blossoms like a flower in front of you in the audience. That's a community of this instant. I had never experienced it in a poetry reading before that. And it's very beautiful. It opens like a flower, and when the reading is over, it closes again and it's gone. But that's the community that the ancient poets knew. That's why Homer was delivered in the way it was and why Beowulf is done in this way. There's a community with the audience that one loses or never knows about if you only write and publish.
And I guess reading at demonstrations, you probably had a great sense of the community of your, listeners, too.
I think so, because they were, sometimes when you go into a poetry reading now or any time, they're not sure if it's a cultural experience or if they should be polite, or that's not a part of the community. The community shouts and screams and says, you know, you're a fascist or whatever they do. All of that's a part of it. And so I prefer boisterous poetry readings to this day.
My guest is poet Robert Bly. Our interview will continue after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Poet Robert Bly is my guest. You turned down, you turned over the $1,000 prize that you got from the National Book Award, and you gave it to an anti-draft book. And I think your publishing company, your small press, was offered, I think, a $5,000 grant from, was it the National Endowment for the Arts?
Yeah.
And you turned that down, and I think I'm quoting you correctly. You said, since we are murdering a culture at least as fine as our own, have we the right to congratulate ourselves on our cultural magnificence? If you were offered a stipend or an award at this point, would you say something similar?
Yeah. I have continued to turn down government money. If the National Endowment grants had been given 8 years before the war, I don't think we would have had so many poets participating. It isn't that they would have been bought. It's that they would have said, well, you know, the government does like poetry. You know, it's that issue. And so I believe with Rex Roth also that the poets should try to get along, conning Guggenheim or whoever they need to, but to stay away from the government so that when another conflict with the government appears, we'll be emotionally clean and not feel grateful to this government.
After your period of activism and of anti-war poetry, you moved to a much more reflective form of poetry again, and really you were plumbing the unconscious. Could you talk a little bit about
Well, you know, the unconscious, what does the unconscious mean? It's a word that isn't very good. It really means what we don't know. What we don't know. What the conscious, what we know. The unconscious, what we don't know. So I'm plumbing what I don't know. Well, having been brought up in the Middle West, which could be called the masculine part of the country, being a Protestant, which is a masculine religion, being a farmer's son, which is a masculine occupation, I had very little development of the feminine side. I'm not sure I still have much. But by trying to investigate the goddesses and the great mother culture, I was really investigating what I didn't know.
What instigated it? You know, you really were changing your focus there a lot.
Well, I think it was reading of Jung.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's my question.
Okay.
And it's a problem I've always had with Jung. He attributes certain qualities to feminine and masculine, to the male side and the female side. Why label it male? Why male certain? Why label certain characteristics as male or female?
That's right. It's a lot of trouble. Causes a lot of trouble. And it can trap both men and women in their areas. For example, the one thing I object to very much in Jung is his saying that feeling belongs really to women and linear thinking or something to men. And I've been doing men's groups now for 5 or 6 years, and slowly I'm developing an idea that there's a male mode of feeling and a female mode of feeling. Those are modes. And the women, the mothers, teach us the female mode of feeling when we're very small, And this is, I mean, we just go to them when we're hurt in the playground, and they talk to us about feeling. They're not doing anything wrong. It's the fathers that are not talking that don't help the young male learn the male motor feeling. Is that clear what I'm saying? And therefore, the men in the last 20 years have been trying to imitate the women and imitate the female motor feeling. It's better than none. But there's also a wonderful thing when you can break out of those categories and move over and realize that the men have very deep feelings of their own and a way of feeling them and a mode of speaking about them, which they are not given any help with by their fathers and now even by their grandfathers, who are mostly gone. So the Chinese do it better because they call that the yang and the yin, and then we're not trapped in the terms male and female.
After several years of pursuing what you called the great mother or the female side of a man, you kind of gave that up almost for a pursuit of male energy.
I didn't give it up, but you know, all the time, I'm looking for what I don't know. I'm trying to look in the unknown part of myself, which is dumb, dark, stupid, and deep, and way down there. And then I realized after working with a mother or something, elementary material really, but news to me, that I didn't know anything about my masculine side either, especially about my relationship with my father.
One other thing on this subject, I know part of the reason for feminism and the women's movement was that many women felt that the mainstream of society was run by men and mm-hmm. defined by men, so mm-hmm. life in general was the way mm-hmm. men defined it, and women were always defined as the other.
Yep.
So in order to define that for themselves in some way, they had to get together and figure out what men were leaving out about women. But one thing that confuses me about some men's groups is, since men were defining all this in the first place, what are they trying to define?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in talking about male gods and so on, it's very interesting that a lot of the work that the men do have done as scholars like Graves and so on, is accurate descriptions of women's experience. But how about the accurate descriptions of men's experience? See, we haven't done much of that.
Men haven't accurately described men's experiences?
No.
But they've accurately described women's experiences?
Not accurately, but intently and obsessively. Do you hear what I'm saying? Graves has a whole book about the white goddess. What about the male god? How come he left out that? It's as if we're fascinated by the other. So we spend all our analytical energy trying to get into that. And it'd take us 2 years to go where a woman could go there in 5 minutes. But then, on our own side, women are not as fascinated with the male as we are with the female in that area. They haven't done much work talking about the male gods and the male energies. And the men have not done either. So therefore, this material is just as undefined for us. And the labor that we have to do is to go ahead and do that. And make sure that we're not trying to shame women in this. This is not a competitive thing with women.
Your imagery, I think, has been very influenced by Jung and also by Freud.
Yeah.
Have you been psychoanalyzed yourself?
No.
Why not? You're so fascinated by this. Why haven't you gone to analysis?
Who knows? It can be said that when you write poems steadily and constantly, it's a form of analysis in itself. That's the way Rilke felt. And after all, I live out in Madison, Minnesota. Who's going to analyze me? It is. You understand? So it's. I'm very interested in therapy, and I believe most therapy is tremendously helpful. I just have been too stubborn to do it.
Are you afraid that therapy would sap your creativity?
No,
or
I don't think so.
Harm your poetry?
No, I don't think so. No.
I want to quote something that you wrote. I can't remember when you wrote it, actually. But you wrote, "Almost all American poets I know suffer each day the anguish of having no family traditions in art, so they don't know which sacrifices are proper to make for the sake of art and which aren't." I thought that was a really interesting statement to make, and I wonder, what are some of the sacrifices you've made for poetry, and ones that you feel you should have made, and others maybe that you've second-guessed?
Well, the major sacrifice that one needs to make for art is some way in which you drop out of busy life somehow and have lots of time for solitude. And sometimes that involves not having any money for a long time. and at other times it involves not receiving that steady assurance every day that people give you when you go to work, and they're there, and you know their little jokes, and they know yours, and they keep supporting you each day in a beautiful way. And somehow that's one of the sacrifices. And then other sacrifices, so I've made some of those, and they've been blessed ones.
One last question. We only have about a minute left. We were talking about sacrifices you as a poet have made in order to write poetry. And I think a question every artist has to ask themselves is what sacrifices are they willing to ask their family to make so that they can be an artist? Because they don't have a 9-to-5 job where you get a regular salary and health benefits and a pension and all that. Has that raised a lot of tough questions for you during your life?
I have one. My last boy now is in a fairly good day school in Minneapolis. The rest of them went to very bad high schools. And there was always an air of chaos around the house from not enough money. And I remember I felt that, I mean, we were glad to have a car that was 10 years old. It seemed a part of the whole thing. But then I remember one of my sons saying to me, you know, Dad, would you let me, he about 4 blocks from the high school, would you let me off a block from the high school? So one suffers some humiliation there, so to speak. Everybody, we have no right to ask our families to go through these sacrifices, but we do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems for us.
Thank you. Thank you for the questions.
Robert Bly's latest collections of poems include Selected Poems and Loving a Woman in Two Worlds, both published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.